be active contributors to the health and well-being of our region. Please consider kicking in $10 or more if you can by visiting mediasanctuary.org and clicking donate, or by mailing a check to P.O. Box 35 in Troy, New York, 12181. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your help. Support for WOOC 105.3 FM Troy comes from listeners like you and from Rock Hill Bakehouse, real food made by real people, available in locations throughout the Capital Region, on Facebook as Rock Hill Bakehouse.
Hello, Capital Region. There we go. Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Dave Pueblo.
And I'm Corinne Carey. Today we have coverage from the recent Clearwater Festival by correspondent Mark Dunley.
Then Paul Winkler of New York Bicycling Coalition will be joining us in the studio to talk about bike policy in New York, electric bikes, and more.
Afterwards, we'll listen to part one of Aaron Pettinati's interview with Rex Smith, editor-in-chief at the Times Union.
And later on, we'll hear the latest segment from our student correspondents at SUNY's Department of Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino Studies. This week features Tai Sipran, Rada Sapkota, and Megan Martinez. But let's start the show off with some headlines.
The Supreme Court ruled on two closely watched challenges to partisan gerrymandering today. Both were unanimous decisions that left the substantive questions surrounding gerrymandering unanswered. The court instead ruled on technical grounds, turning potential constitutional blockbusters into minor rulings. The decision left the door open to further challenges and are considered a setback for critics of partisan gerrymandering, who had hoped that the Supreme Court would more closely scrutinize the oddly shaped districts that amplify one political party's power over another. The new court challenge to partisan gerrymandering from North Carolina now waits in the wings and could allow the justices to try again to find a standard that could allow constitutional challenges to voting maps warped by politics.
The Times Union reports that FBI agents are actively investigating Crystal Run Healthcare, a Hudson Valley company whose officials gave $400,000 in political donations to Governor Andrew Cuomo. Crystal Run received $25 million in grants to build two facilities which had broken ground 6 months before the subsidies were awarded. The Times Union had earlier reported that the Manhattan District Attorney's Office was investigating the contracts.
Meanwhile, much of the state's political attention will focus on a courtroom in New York City where Cuomo administration officials and campaign donors go on trial this week over allegations that they rigged contracts in awarding the Buffalo Billion Economic Development Program. In a related development, Stephanie Miner, the former mayor of Syracuse and a former top official in the New York Democratic Party, announced her independent run for governor, the latest surprise twist in Governor Andrew Cuomo's bid for re-election. She announced her candidacy in a tweet in response to a New York Times article. Quote, I cannot be a silent witness to what I think is a corrupt political culture that is hurting people, real people, every day, Ms. Miner said in announcing her run.
This week is the last week of the state legislative session. Senate Republicans have put together a number of issues into a quote-unquote big ugly bill, but the measure likely has little chance of passage in the Assembly. The legislation includes modifications to an Assembly bail reform plan, a provision that would seal arrest records of low-level marijuana offenders, and authorization for construction of the AirTran to LaGuardia Airport. The bill would also let New York City extend its speed camera program and would also eliminate regional caps on the number of charter schools. Meanwhile, Governor Cuomo continues to push passage of a quote-unquote red flag gun control bill that would allow teachers, school officials, family members, and law enforcement to petition a judge when they fear someone is dangerous and has access to guns.
The New York Times has endorsed former Cuomo press aide Gareth Rhodes in the crowded Democratic primary to challenge Republican incumbent John Faso in the 19th Congressional District. The Times noted that, like several of his competitors, Mr. Rhodes backs Medicare for All, a health care reform meant to bring Americans closer to the kind of universal system enjoyed by all other industrial nations. The primary will be held next Tuesday. Rhodes also promotes gun safety. Also running in this race is former New Paltz School Board member Steve Greenfield, who obtained the Green Party nomination.
Thanks to a $4 million grant from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, less food will end up in our state's landfills. The grant will help large stores and restaurants recycle food waste by expanding capacity for food donation and composting. This program will help increase access to healthy food and reduce food waste.
The city of Schenectady has begun a 3-year project to become more environmentally friendly, smart city by installing new streetlights and signals that are more energy efficient and will improve emergency response times.
For those of you just tuning in, my computer has just died.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. Every year on Father's Day weekend, Clearwater, the organization founded by Pete Seeger, holds a festival along the Hudson River to celebrate music and promote environmental action. WOOC talked with Edie Kantowitz of the New York City Friends of Clearwater and Mana Jo Green, the Environmental Action Coordinator of Clearwater.
So we're at the Clearwater Festival, and we're talking with Edie Kantowitz, who is with the New York City Friends of Clearwater. So, Edie, what are some of the Friends of Clearwater up to these days?
Oh, well, we're working on lots of issues these days. I mean, Clearwater and New York City Friends of Clearwater were originally associated with cleaning up the Hudson River, but now it's gone far beyond that. We're dealing with all kinds of water issues that affect the Hudson River, New York City's drinking water, the waterways surrounding New York City. And then it goes even beyond that because all of the things that affect our environment more deeply, like fracking, like climate change, these affect the river and they affect every aspect of our environment. And so, you know, dealing with climate change is very important to us right now. And we're also dealing with plastics. We're dealing with plastic bags. We're dealing with, we just recently got implementation of the styrofoam ban for New York City, so that's a wonderful thing. So, you know, we're just trying to do what we can on all different directions.
So in New York City, what are some of the climate change issues that the Clearwater has touched on?
Well, we've been, you know, looking at divestment. You know, we've been pretty happy with the divestment situation for New York City, but I think now we need to focus a little more on the state. Annapolis doesn't seem to be too eager to do divestment for New York State, but we want to, you know, just keep calling and keep doing whatever we can, you know, to tell people that we have to do this. Also, any kind of fossil fuel usage is really making climate change worse, okay? So we have to oppose fossil fuels. That's not only carbon dioxide, but it's very much methane. Natural gas is 86 times as intensive for climate change compared to carbon dioxide. And we need to be using only clean, sustainable, renewable energy, which would be solar, wind power, geothermal, and of course not nuclear, because that's got its only very dangerous problems.
And if people wanted to find out more about Friends of Clearwater New York City, how best can they do that?
Go to our website, www.nycfriendsofclearwater.org, and we also have a Facebook page.
And that was Edie Kantowitz of New York City Friends of Clearwater. So we're talking with Mana Jo Green, who's the Environmental Action Coordinator for Clearwater right here at the annual Clearwater Festival. So you had this little sign on you, Mana Jo, ask me about climate solutions. What does that mean?
Well, you know, we've been talking about climate change for decades now. Jimmy Carter put solar up on the White House, and then Ronald Reagan came and took it down. We can't just be talking about it. We have to be actually doing something about it. Last fall, we saw hurricanes from Texas to Florida to the Caribbean, Puerto Rico. And then we saw the fires out in California. And the amount of loss and damage and human suffering is of epic proportions. But if we talk about mitigating climate change, it sounds like you're making it less bad. We don't want to make it less bad. We want to solve it. We created the problem. We can solve the problem. So I'm a fan of Drawdown, which Paul Hawken created, which is a group of scientists who have studied what climate solutions can actually bring the Earth back into balance, not only avoiding more greenhouse gases, but sequestering, taking up and holding back in the ground the carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that are causing the greenhouse effect that are that is responsible for global warming. So we're here not just talking about solar energy and wind and switching to a renewable energy economy, but what can farmers do? Because soil and a healthy agricultural system can take up carbon. How important is it to preserve our forests, which also take up carbon? So if you're putting up a solar system, don't cut down a forest to do it. Find a landfill or a brownfield site. So if we put our heads together and work collectively, I really believe that we can solve the climate crisis, not just mitigate it and make it less bad, because that's not very inspiring. But solving it, implementing real solutions. So if people want more information on that, I highly recommend www.drawdown.org, because it lists over 100 solutions and what they will cost, how much greenhouse gases they will either prevent being released or take back up. The oceans are also a really significant part of the climate solution if we foster kelp farms and not destroy our coral reefs, and in so many other ways that the oceans can be part of the solution. So let's find out about those solutions, and let's create legislation and policy that will implement that, so that I have a new grandson and I'm seeing all the children here at Revival, that they will have a healthy, environmentally sound future as we inherited, but either for lack of information or for outright greed, have really done a lot of damage to.
Now, I understand that Assemblymember D.D. Barrett has introduced some legislation for a carbon tax credit for farmers to put carbon back into the soil. But are there other programs that, for instance, taking place, say, in the Hudson Valley, which help farmers with the concept of, like, regenerative agriculture?
I don't know of any other for regenerative agriculture, but it certainly is a critical part of the solution. But I do know that in Ulster County, we've started a 100 business challenge. We're trying to get 100 businesses to implement solar, to switch to electric vehicles and put in charging stations that are solar powered, to do an energy retrofit, to start composting if they're large food waste generators, and many of the drawdown solutions. If they can implement that, they become a green business leader. And the response has been phenomenal. And I think part of it is because the manifestations of the global climate crisis are so real to people that they want to help. They want to do something. And agriculture is a critical part of the solution. Wetlands and marshes also are another part of the solution. So looking at the ecosystem services that are provided by various different parts of nature, rather than thinking of it just for our enjoyment, but understanding that these natural systems are what have kept the Earth in balance, and that if we learn from them and implement them, we can restore that balance.
So we got about 2 minutes left. So is nuclear power, one of those solutions?
If you'll notice on the sign promoting our climate solutions, we stopped at number 19 because Drawdown with regret lists nuclear power as number 20, and Clearwater has been very concerned not just about Indian Point but about the amount of nuclear waste that all nuclear plants are generating. And those communities, once the plants close down, Indian Point is closing in 2020 and 2021, but in the next decade, most of the nuclear facilities in the United States will be phased out. And those communities are left with massive amounts of highly radioactive nuclear waste. I think that for those people in the environmental community that are debating nuclear or not nuclear, they're ignoring the problem of the long-term and very serious problem of 45, 50 years of nuclear waste being stored on site.
And if people want more information about Clearwater, how best to do that?
www.clearwater.org.
And that was Mana Jo Green, the Environmental Action Coordinator for Clearwater.
That was a report from WOOC correspondent Mark Dunley about the recent Clearwater Festival in the Croton State Park.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM.
Okay. WOOC correspondent Aaron Pednotti recently visited the Times Union headquarters in Albany to talk to the paper's editor, Rex Smith. This is part one of their conversation.
I'm Aaron Pednotti, and today I'm interviewing Rex Smith, the editor and vice president of Albany's Times Union newspaper, about the challenges of producing locally and regionally based news in the age of Trump. Rex, thanks very much for sitting down for this interview. It's great to have you on the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So to start out, I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of how the Times Union negotiates a challenge that's often faced by newspapers located in the capital city of an American state, which is that its target readership is made up of a somewhat mixed demographic. At one level, you're expected to serve as a news source for the city of Albany, but Albany is the central city of the Capital District and the Capital Region, so you're also expected to cover news in Schenectady, Rensselaer, and Saratoga counties. But given that Albany is also the state capital, you're expected to cover state politics and other important stories and news at a statewide level. Then, at the level of the national media, there's a certain expectation that the Times Union serve as both a go-to source of New York State politics news and a kind of unofficial voice of Albany. So my question is, how does the Times Union juggle the pressures of this complicated situation?
You know, every newspaper has to juggle the reality of the fact that we don't have enough resources to do everything that we need to do. That is especially more challenging now in the digital age as newsrooms have shrunk, and we can talk about that a bit. With respect to the capital region specifically, you're right that we have an unusual challenge, let's say. Because not only do we have the responsibility to be the watchdog on state government, which we take very seriously, we have the largest bureau in the state capital of any news outlet in the state, but we also have an unusual community in that we don't have a center city with suburbs surrounding us the way many communities do. The Capital Region really is a suburban community. We are a cluster of small cities with suburbs in filling. So actually, we have more readers in the town of Colony than we do in the city of Albany. Our largest school district is Shenandoah. It's not Albany City. So we really need to be respectful of the fact that people are looking for a little bit of everything from the Times Union. That said, we can't be all things to all people. We have to be choosy in deciding that we're going to cover things that we think have the greatest potential for making a difference in people's lives and fulfilling our responsibility in democratic society to be that watchdog. So we do give more attention to state government and politics than another news organization might in a community of this size, because nobody else is going to do it if we don't. We also think that that kind of watchdog reporting makes good business sense. It is what sets us apart. Every business needs to have something that makes it unique in the marketplace, that gives it a niche. For us, it is that watchdog reporting on state and local government, which the TV stations here don't do. The other newspapers are too small to do. The out-of-town media that are serving the capital region don't really look at it the way we do, because they are resource-constrained at the state capital. So the result is we have a heavier diet of state government watchdog reporting and political reporting than many of our suburban readers might want, but we think we are serving those state readers who really care about it. That is particularly shown by the fact that our digital presence is enormous on days when the state workforce is here. Monday is our biggest day digitally. It's our smallest day in print. But on Monday, when the state workers show up at their office, our digital presence just spikes. TimesUnion.com goes crazy. It is our biggest day. So we know that we are being read by state workers at their desks often. And that means that we need to deliver to them, especially this content on state government and politics. For our local readers, we try to give them stuff that is important as well as interesting. And sometimes that means just a sweet story about some athlete at a high school here who has achieved a lot, or a fun story about what's happened to somebody who was once prominent and is now driving an Uber or something. So we find that we are constantly adjusting what we're doing, but we are cognizant of the fact that this state government coverage is something that is a special responsibility for us.
Okay, so that touches on a number of complicated challenges that come to bear on your job as editor of the Times Union. Now I want to turn to a factor that's likely making it even more challenging for you, namely the extent to which the Trump administration has been drawing the attention of news consumers away from issues of local, regional, and even state-level importance and towards the daily antics of the president. Based on what you know about your own readership, what sort of effect is this having on people's interest in news stories that are closer to home, and how is the Times Union responding to that situation?
Well, our niche as the provider of unique content on local and state issues means that our front page rarely has national news, even in the era of Trump, when he seems to suck all the oxygen out of the room for every other kind of content nationally. We figure that people get a full helping of Trump news by watching cable television, by looking at national media. Especially in the digital era, there's no reason why people have to turn to the Times Union for that. So we give them some of that inside our newspaper, not on the front page, because there's no reason for us to replicate what they can get in greater depth with reporting from those other sources. We instead make our front page filled with state and local news. Our opinion pages, however, reflect the broad range of content, and we think people appreciate that. We're about a third and a third and a third national, state, and local in the content on our opinion pages. But I do think that the impact of the Trump era on local news is twofold, at least. First, people's attention, yes, is diverted from what's going on locally, and their attention, as even reflected in their conversations with each other in the supermarkets or at parties and the like, is about Trump. So yes, people's attention is diverted from what's local to what's national. And second, his constant attacks on the media. In the aftermath of his meeting in Singapore, he said that the greatest enemy of America is the news media. What an outrageous thing for a president to say. What an outrageous, unpatriotic thing for a president to say. And so that really undermines our credibility, I'm afraid, even with our local citizens, our readers, even on matters of local news. And I think that is going to end up being a terrible effect at the end of the Trump presidency, that he will have had the effect of significantly diminishing the capability of the American media to serve its traditional role of watchdog.
So as the editor of a paper that focuses considerable attention on state, regional, and local news, can you comment specifically on the impact that Trump is having on how much people are following news related to the state assembly and the Cuomo administration? Are there any big stories in state politics that aren't getting quite the public attention they deserve due to the focus on Trump?
I think that's true, not so much because the Trump coverage diverts our limited news hole as much as the impact on people's attention span and their own interest. Folks have become accustomed to the notion that you can't trust what a politician says. If everything coming out of the White House is hyperbole, as is the case, you know, he's back and forth on this and that. Kim Jong-un goes from being a little rocket man one day to being highly respected 6 months later. And so there is little expectation, diminishing expectation, I should say, on the part of our readers that what they are hearing from government is credible and worth paying attention to, because what you hear today may not be what you hear tomorrow, because everybody believes that facts are now fungible. So I do think that the impact on our readers has been diminishing attention to, diminishing concern about matters of government at the state level, as well as the local level, because of what they've seen coming out of Washington. It's not so much that the Times Union is covering Trump world at a greater extent than it did the Obama administration, but it is that people's sensibilities have changed and people's attention to matters of news have been affected by the rawness that has been created by the approach that the Trump administration has taken to issues and facts.
So, last question. Can you give us your thoughts on how people who think that local and regional news is important can encourage others to follow it?
Well, if I could figure out how to get more people to follow local and regional news, I would be really happy about that, because it would assure the future of the Times Union, which I do think will be, as media diminish, the surviving brand in this marketplace will be the Times Union as we evolve from ink on crushed trees to being a digital presence on all platforms. You know, the problem is that the loss of local media is significant. There's a new study coming out of the University of Notre Dame, I believe, the business college, that finds that when local media have disappeared, the cost of government has risen because there is less attention to what's going on. So the local media really have an impact on local government. I think that to get more people to pay attention to the news that is covered by the local media, it's really our responsibility in the media to do our jobs better. If we make our report more compelling, if we use all the tools at our disposal to bring the news to where the people are, then we will be more present in their lives. And by the latter, I mean, we can't just say, well, we put out the news in print and toss it on the doorsteps of people who want it and we've done our job. We need to effectively use social media. We need to put news in front of people in forms that they can make use of it. And that even means tailoring the stories to different demographics so that we can make news consumable, credible, useful, so that we can deserve part of the mind share of the audience here in this community.
Well, thanks again for this interview, Rex. It was great talking to you.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
And for the members of our listening audience, please tune in next week for another interview with Rex about the ways that the contemporary crisis of newspapers has impacted the news climate of the Capital Region.
That was Aaron Pednotti talking to Times Union editor Rex Smith about local and regional news coverage in the Trump era. For those just tuning in, I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm Corinne Carey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or ebullient admiration, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 on weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
In our next segment, we hear from Tai Sipran, Radha Sapkota, and Megan Martinez. All three are students in the Department of Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino Studies at SUNY Albany. They worked with their fellow students to produce radio pieces about race, class, and cultural identity that air every week right here on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Hello, welcome. My name is Taisi Bram. I'm Dominican and I identify myself as Afro-Latina. I'm a freshman at the University of Albany and my major is sociology and minor in criminal justice.
Hi, my name is Radha Sapkota. I am a Nepalese American and I prefer to call myself as Nepali. I am a senior at UAlbany as an economics major and business minor.
Hello, my name is Megan Martinez. I'm a psych major and criminal justice minor. I'm a freshman. I identify as an Afro-Latina. The theme for our conversation today is culture and identity, and we're going to start off with a question. So, Thais, what have you learned about yourself since you got into UAlbany?
Coming to Albany was a new experience to me. The area is different culture, and that I had to learn how to get used to it. Coming to Albany, where the dominant race was white people, was really different for me because I live in a neighborhood where most people are Black and Hispanic. But on the other side, coming to Albany taught me how to be independent, be on my own, have this freedom to make my own decisions, and if I do a mistake, then that's on me. I learned how to be more mature, learned about myself a little bit more. Every day I learn about myself, and it's just helped me grow more as a person and as mentally too.
UAlbany has a great impact on myself and my life because coming from a different environment from Nepal to here in America is a huge social and cultural difference where you have to adjust yourself in everyday life. In the beginning, coming to UAlbany was just to achieve a degree for me, but after coming here, it is more than degree or education. It is about learning the reality of American society, American life, American culture, which looks so beautiful from our outer world, like from different world, it means like different country. But when you come here, you know the reality of the life over here, how you struggle, how is the American life here. And I have seen diversity in UAlbany, which is very important to construct a respected environment to everyone who came here to their higher education. Especially, I will always honor this class because of which I knew so much about coloniality, decoloniality, and its importance on American government, importance in American government, which took to America, like Great America, which make Americans Great Americans. They prefer to call them Great Americans. So that's what I have learned till now. And if I haven't took this class, I'll not know like what is the real America. So I think I knew so much thing about American culture. And I'll pass this question to Megan.
What I've learned about myself since I've gotten to UA is, like, who I am as a person. Like, I've been more independent than I was back at home. And I've also learned a lot about my culture. Coming to this class, it's like, I didn't know a lot, like, decoloniality. And it's just, it was really surprising to learn all this about my culture and not knowing it before. Because they didn't teach us this in high school. But I feel like that played a big role in my education. And, like, just... like, being here in UA, it's just really opened my eyes to a lot of things. And, Thais, do you have anything else you want to say?
I agree with Radha. Because before I came to Albany and not being in the Latin Caribbean class, I really didn't know the reality of, like, how the U.S. really is. Coming to this class, I learned how corrupt this the U.S. is. And how, like, a lot of people get brainwashed as the U.S. being the best, you know, which is very equal, inequality, it gives a lot of equality and stuff like that. And just coming to this class, I really learned the reality of, like, what really happened between other countries and, like, how it really came about and, like, who was really the persons that were involved. Because back in high school, you really didn't get to learn those things. And just coming to this class, you know, I'm proud I took this class because I opened my mind more. So,
who else is my question?
So, now I'm going to ask a question. Have you ever experienced culture shock? This is Surada.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. If I had to say personally, no, I haven't ever experienced culture shock or something like that directly on me, because I always stayed in my own community, in my own circle. I had my own Nepalese circle where I felt so comfortable, and I always used to stay on that circle. Basically, I never tried to go on such places where I could face such problem like racism, discrimination, or ignorance, which from which I fear a lot. I scared a lot from those problems. So I have never went on those places. So I haven't faced those problems. But I'm trying to go on others community too. I want to learn like more about American society, other people, other race. So now I'm trying to go on others group too. But I hope so I'll not face this problem in my future. this question passed to Megan.
I never really had culture shock because I came from a high school where it was always people of color. Like it was probably one or two white teachers, but that was it. And I guess that was like really beautiful in a way because I didn't have to. Like, I experienced a lot, like, with my culture and, like, other people's culture from people of color, which was pretty amazing. But coming to UA, I think I got too comfortable being around people like me. So, like, I don't put myself out there, so I've never really gotten the chance to experience culture shock, even though I don't want to. And then I feel like that's become a bad habit, though, because, like, I don't give myself the chance to meet other people or, like, explore other cultures and stuff. And a way I could, like, get out of that is by just stepping out of my comfort zone and maybe joining organizations that doesn't have to do with my culture or, like, my people. So maybe I'll experience culture shock once I step out my comfort zone, but for now I haven't. Thais, do you want to talk about your question?
I just want to add with what you guys are saying. I agree. I always was with my Dominicans. Like, I really didn't, you know, leave that little click, you could say, because I just feel like we just feel comfortable. Like, we went through the same struggles. We go through the same type of stereotypes. So it's, like, it's a little bit hard because you're going to feel like the outsider when you go to a different click, even though it's not always good because you should always try new things, try to meet new people, try to learn their culture and why they're like this and stuff like that. So, like, I want to, and I hope... Hopefully, like, I agree with you, Megan, and hopefully in the future I get to go to a different type of clique, like, you know, maybe, I don't know, like, experience something new, you know, not only be with my people, my Dominicans, you know, I don't want to be that type of person. This goes to Rada.
Thank you, guys, for your opinion about it. I have one question on my mind. It always bothered me. I want to ask you, ask both of you, what will be your reaction whenever you face like culture shock or like racism or discrimination, like directly on your own. So, what will be your reaction? I'll pass this to Thais.
Thank you. I feel like you don't really know how to react when you actually are in that situation. Just for the fact, like, okay, maybe you say, like, oh, I will talk back. Or maybe I will stay quiet. But you don't know what you will do because you will be surprised. I never experienced racism or discrimination. Like, I've seen many of my friends experience that and tell me how many didn't even react because they were surprised of, like, there's still so much discrimination and race still happening here, and it's already 2018. So they're like, wow, it's still really going on. Especially I have many friends that are still, like, they're black, and they're, like, they're still being discriminated. Like, their parents, like, many have worked with white people, and they get more opportunities than blacks. It's all right because I'm Hispanic. Happens the same thing for me. The stereotypes of being Hispanic, oh, you're a dropout, you get pregnant, and stuff like that, you know, and so on. It never changes. It's never going to change. Like, so I don't know how I'll react, and hopefully I don't react in a negative way because, you know, yeah. So I'll pass this to Megan.
Just like Thais said, I've never really, like, experienced discrimination myself, so I wouldn't really know how to act. But I feel like when someone else, like, gets discriminated, I really do stand up and, like, I talk back. And I, like, I don't always do it in a rude way. Like, I try to do it in, like, in an educating them kind of way. So I don't, like, get stereotyped, like, oh, she's an angry Latina, or they always have attitudes, things like that. And I feel like if I do experience like discrimination or culture shock, I would react in a really bad way, but not on purpose. Like, it's just like a reflex, I guess. But I guess we would have to just try to fix that ourselves so we're not always stereotyped as these ridiculous things. But Radha, do you want to answer your question?
Thank you, Megan, and thank you, Thais, for your opinion. I was curious about that because I haven't faced culture shock and I haven't react like I haven't ever react like in an aggressive way or something like that. But I am. I think we should be like well prepared, because we are immigrants and we can face that problem anytime in our life. So, yeah, and I think we should be well prepared for that. So not even for ourselves, but in future for by our children too, they can face it either. So we should like learn like how to react on that problem. But obviously, it is like very bitter experience when you face that problem. I think that's all from my side. Do you want to add, Megan? Do you want to add something?
Well. Thank you for listening.
That was Tai Sipran, Radha Sepkoda, and Megan Martinez, students at the University at Albany Department of Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino Studies. Student productions about race, class, and cultural identity air every week right here on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
For our next segment, we welcome Paul Winkeller to our studio. Paul is the executive director of the nonprofit New York Bicycling Coalition. Paul was NYBC's very first executive director and is once again serving in that role. NYBC describes itself as, quote, the premier resource for bicycling advocacy and information in New York State, end quote. NYBC's stated mission also is, quote, to provide a voice for bicyclists throughout New York State, whether you use a bicycle for daily transportation, ride on or off-road, ride for recreation, or take part in races. We represent the interests of all bicyclists and envision a future where bicyclists feel safe, respected, and fully integrated into the transportation system, end quote. Welcome, Paul.
Hi.
So that mission statement certainly hits on many of the key issues, the safety, integration, and mutual respect. And you've served as an executive director for NYBC twice now since its founding and the present. What are some of the big changes you've observed as far as bicycling in New York?
Well, it's ironic, but every time I go to public events, I was at ED 17 years ago when we first secured funding for staff. We'd been founded about 12 years earlier by volunteers. And the ironic thing is that when I go to events now, and there are a lot of events celebrating complete streets, new opportunities for bicycles and pedestrians, trails opening, the politicians, the elected officials sound like I used to sound 15 years ago. So that's a good thing. That's a good thing, although we still have a long way to go to have a truly shared multimodal transportation system.
So what are the things that you've seen that, you know, were big events, and maybe what are the things that, obviously, you probably have a list of things that you want to see happen for bicyclists in the state?
Well, New York State, as judged by the League of American Bicyclists, they do a pretty regular survey of bike-friendly states. We are, sadly, only 23rd in the country. We used to be 42nd. We had something to do, I think, with driving that ranking upward. But there are things that we don't do yet in New York State, and I could
like
cite
what?
Them. We don't spend as much money as other states on bike safety and pedestrian safety education, bicycle and pedestrian crashes in New York State. We are among the worst in the country. In fact, by some measures, we are the worst, dominated by pedestrians killed. But, you know, so we don't spend a lot of money on education awareness. We spend a lot of money on complete streets and infrastructure, but not as much percentage-wise on a per capita basis as other states. We don't spend as much funds on training law enforcement to enforce the vehicular and traffic laws as they relate to bicycling and walking. We do spend large amounts of money on bicycling, like the Empire Trail, which the governor announced that's opening in 2020, the Empire State Trail, and the grandest bike path in the planet, I think, which is the new 12-foot shared-use path on the new Mario Cuomo Bridge, which used to be known as the Tappan Zee. So we spend the money, but we don't really do some of the, we don't hit some of those marks that make us special. Then there are legislative issues, which we can talk about as well.
Okay. So let's stick with some of the safety stuff for right now, because I'm thinking about, especially the, I was reading about some of the stuff that you were talking about earlier, in terms of like the bike to pedestrian incidents. And I was surprised that that was so high. Is it all around the state? Is it primarily in New York City?
No. There are what's called in the lingo hotspots. And some of the funding we receive from the state, from the Governor's Traffic Safety Committee, is to focus on hotspots. One of them is actually in the Capital Region on Central Avenue. Long Island has some really dangerous infrastructure points, Rochester, Buffalo. So there are hotspots around the state which seem to be places where there are regularly crashes and people injured or killed. And, you know, those are things that can be fixed by education, by better enforcement, by infrastructure upgrades.
I mean, in Troy, I've noticed since I've been here, for about 2.5 years, and I have extensive bicycling experience in urban environments, 13 years in Boston, 5 years in New York City, various other locations.
Good cities to bike.
Huh?
Great cities to bike.
Oh, they can be. They can also be very deadly.
Sure.
I got stories for you. Troy is the first place that I've been where it seems like people predominantly bike the wrong direction in traffic, which I have to believe.
It's called salmoning.
Is that what it's called?
It's called salmoning. You know, one of the reasons that happens is that, now I'm old, so I know that when I grew up, actually outside of Boston, when we were in grade school, and this doesn't happen in New York, police would come by in grade school and they would teach you how to ride a bike. That is actually an unenforced mandate on the books in New York State. We have tried to get meetings with state ed to talk about ways that we can educate children about walking and biking safely as part of their life skills, as part of their life path toward healthy living. Mm-hmm. We think we've made some real inroads by presenting several times now around the state to regional meetings of phys ed teachers. Phys ed teachers are a way to get into schools. It's very hard to get into schools with all the mandates that teachers bear. But a lot of people don't know how to ride a bike, don't know the rules of the road. Mm-hmm. Law enforcement, sadly, does also, in many cases, not know the rules. They spend very little time when they're trained at the academies studying the V&T laws having to do with bicycling. And some of our funding, again, such as the video you saw on our website, is to work with police departments so that their officers on the ground know the laws better, and their default is education as opposed to penalizing badly behaving bicyclists. We need to be very careful about not blaming bicyclists. That is sometimes the default. In this country, when a crash happens, the bicyclist is often blamed. In Europe, the paradigm is exactly opposite. So we need to think about bicycling in a little bit different way in this country.
Right. Plus, we have a very punitive culture on that front anyway.
We sure do.
You know, and that's how we approach prison as well.
We sure do. Luckily, we're not imprisoning bicyclists.
Not many.
So you touched on earlier that there's a whole legislative side to this, and I know that there are at least two or three hot button issues that are going on right now. Why don't we talk about those?
Well, we're approaching the end of the session, and we're entering the phase that I'm told is called the Big Ugly.
Right.
And in the Big Ugly, we're hoping finally that New York State enters the 21st century and legalizes Class 1 electric bikes. Class 1 e-bikes are the ones that are also called pedal assist. You have to pedal to get assistance, which you ask for. We like pedal assist e-bikes. Legislation's being passed in other states. They get more people on bikes, people who are physically challenged. They are a tremendous option for bike share. Every bike share in New York State, including our wonderful bike share program in the Capital Region, would like to add a Class 1 e-bike to their roster. I mean, there are hills. I mean, we want to get up Route 7. You want to get up State Street. A Class 1 option as part of bike share. Bike share is happening. E-bikes are being sold. They're not technically illegal. They're not really legal. They're sort of gray. We'd like to clarify their status as just another form of bicycle. That legislation is bottled up right now in the Assembly. It's really complicated. This is the fourth year of a campaign to legalize electric bikes.
What are the complications?
New York City has, the mayor in New York just issued a rule declaring that Class 1 e-bikes, in their mind, are in fact legal after a lot of struggling with Class 2 e-bikes and delivery workers. The state, the Transportation Committee that has taken up this bill the last 4 years is not yet got to a place where they're willing to put legislation up for a vote that matches the New York City bill, which we like. The legislature is, at this point, we're working really hard with our allies in New York and around the state. We have an e-bike chain gang around the state of volunteers that have been trying to marshal their resources all over the state with editorials and letters and calls and emails. We're semi-optimistic. You never know what's going to happen at the end of the legislature.
Yeah, especially with this. I mean, because this sounds to me.
We don't have money. We don't have lobbyists.
Well, there's that from your end, but there's also the Cuomo versus de Blasio aspect of this that might creep in there. And then the upstate versus New York City issue that might creep in there, because this, as an issue, seems to originate, as you mentioned, with delivery people in New York City more than any other thing. However much those bicycles might be useful in this area, it's just not that kind of
notable. We don't think it's a – yeah, I mean, that's a good point. We don't think this is a Cuomo de Blasio thing. We think – we know that this administration, the leadership, would like to see Class 1 e-bikes pass in New York and match the legislation of the states and provide this new bicycle option. It's just very difficult at the end of a session – to get things through when you don't have a lot behind you. It's a crazy way to govern.
Right.
The other issue that actually, when we survey our membership, dirty little secret is that e-bikes, when we survey our statewide constituency, rank low in their interests. What they're really interested in, and we've been trying this for 4 years as well, and we can't even get a vote on this bill in the Assembly Transportation Committee, is to match what 30 states have done now, which is to pass a defined safe passing. New York has a generic safe passing law which says that drivers need to be safe. It has no teeth. We want to add a 3-foot standard to that. 3 foot is about your arm width or handlebar width. 30 states have that. We want to see that law passed and enforced. That's a big issue. We cannot get that. We cannot move that bill. It is absolutely the number one priority of our membership and our supporters. And we believe if that law passed, it was enforced, we would drive down those horrible crash statistics in New York.
So I see that actually as an issue that goes hand in hand with other bike issues in terms of lanes that are specifically marked, especially with barriers so that vehicles just can't weave in and out of them, and especially in New York City, police cars can't park in them. But
other people can and do.
Yeah, there's that's a key part of it, really. And also when you get into more rural parts of New York State. I understand that many years ago, and this might have been down in like the Beacon area, they were trying to put bike lanes outside of city limits along the roadside because it looked like there was space for it, and they got essentially sued by property owners in that area saying you can't infringe on this area, and they lost, and so that kind of eliminated the idea of bike lanes in rural sections. Have you ever heard anything like that? Or
no? Are you talking about protected bike lanes, like or striped or?
No, this was pre. This was before that era of, yeah. of that being, you know, part of the dialogue in New York State.
Yeah, that's a new one. I haven't heard of that one. But again, you know, there's this education component, which is that we all pay for the road system, including bicyclists and walkers. Mm-hmm. We want to drive down carbon numbers. We want to reduce congestion and pollution. We are equal. Bicyclists and walkers are equal in the eyes of the laws in terms of the road system, and we want our fair share.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So,
and we're going to address that. I will do a shameless plug. We're having our second New York Bike Summit this fall at the Gideon Putnam in Saratoga Springs. It's on September 28th, which is actually coincidentally National Bike Your Park Day. So we're having a bike summit in a park. Among many issues are women's issues relating to women in cycling, a lot of equity issues. There's e-bikes, bike share, a lot of education. We have a really robust roster of panels. It's a big tent event. We have advocates, community bike shops like Troy Bike Rescue, which I love that program. It's one of the best in the state.
Mm-hmm.
We have planners and engineers, a lot of bureaucrats. I think there's a broad agreement now, which is, again, why those elected officials say the things that we used to say 20 years ago, that we really do need to have a truly shared and safe road and trail system. It's just at this point we need to bring people together to sort of figure out the specific action steps to get there. We're not outsiders anymore. What we want has been kind of mainstream, but we just don't devote the resources to get there yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have things like a bike summit.
So we just got about a couple minutes left. Maybe if you want to talk about advocating for bikes at the state fair a little bit more.
Oh, yeah. This was one of those crazy ideas that you put in a message to an important person. We have a supporter from New York City named Steve Stolman who suggested he was involved in the bike messenger movement in the 80s, and he said, why don't you go to the state fairs and put up a giant sign that says free bike rides? Because, you know, people are paying for rides. Just turn on the 80,000 people that come every day to the joy of bicycling and have all kinds of bikes, mountain bikes, cargo bikes, e-bikes, bike share bikes, and just have enough people there to gently introduce New Yorkers. Again, 80,000 people a day, a million people go to the state fair. So it was a throwaway line in an email. The governor's office responded really positively. They're giving us space. So we will have free bike rides at the New York State Fair. And in between eating a lot of wild food, we're going to get a lot of people on different kinds of bikes. So it's kind of, we're really excited about that. And we'd like to be at every state fair and every county fair. Because the more people get on a bike and the more we improve our infrastructure and provide better education, the healthier we're going to be and the stronger New York State's going to be.
Great. Why don't we finish up with you giving us some information, contact information for your organization and
yes,
we're anything else you want to add.
Our website is nybc.net. I'm at paul@nybc.net. You can also write nybc@nybc.net. We're about to launch a new website. We have a lot of information on our current website. We are looking for volunteers to come out to the state fair and turn the New Yorkers on to bicycling. We are also, just to give a plug to what's happening in this region, there's a lot of really great things going on. Albany Bike Coalition, Transport Troy, Troy Bike Rescue, Albany Bike Rescue, this bike rescue in Schenectady. There are a lot of pieces here. One of the things we don't have in this state is enough people getting paid to be bike advocates. That's an issue, and that's, again, why we have a bike summit and why we exist as an organization to provide that kind of support and training so we can have more people paid to pull all these elements together.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming in.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That was Paul Winkeller, Executive Director of New York Bicycling Coalition.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm Corinne Carey. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or the sudden urge to express your gratitude, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, WOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.